Hello and welcome back to the Stadio Podcast. I'm Musa Kwonga.
I'm Ryan Hun.
Ryan, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, man. How are you?
I'm well. The football gods have been busy this weekend. Very busy indeed.
They've also been messy.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, when I was going to say, when are they not? But they've been particularly messy this weekend, for sure.
Yes. There was some wild games this weekend.
There were indeed.
There was a load of derbies. We were thinking about doing those first, but I think we're going to save those for the end.
Mm.
Load of derbies, some classics, some Premier League nonsense again.
Mm.
We'll cover it all. We'll cover it all. But
we'll
cover as much of it as we can. We probably can't get through all of it because it was so chaotic.
Mm.
But just a fun, I think quite a fun weekend for football.
It was.
Did you have fun, Musa?
I did.
As the rain fell on Old Trafford.
Well, I mean, I must say the thing is the weather in Berlin was astonishing. So I did spend a substantial amount of time out and about. But of course I was at home in my flat to watch the Manchester United Liverpool game, which delivered plenty of vitamins. Not all the vitamins, but
I did want it to end, man. I'm not going to lie.
I think Bruno Fernandes wants Liverpool as an opponent every week because I think he gets to feel everything.
We'll talk about this.
Yeah. We'll get to that.
We're thinking about whether we do this first, but we're not actually going to do something else first because there was a far bigger story this weekend.
There was. Bigger story, bigger game.
Before that, we hope everyone's staying safe, staying well. Just a quick bit of admin. Righty's House will go up late on Tuesday after Arsenal-Bayern. You and I will be back on Thursday with the rest of the Champions League stuff. So today, we are going to talk about Athletic Club's Copa del Rey victory.
We are.
We're going to talk about Manchester United, Liverpool and the rest of the Premier League. And then we will do some other stuff. But anyway, let's get into it all after this.
Let's do it.
Right, man, we have to go to Seville. We have to begin there. Mm. In the early hours of Sunday morning, 9:01 in the morning, to be precise, Athletic Club won their first major trophy in 40 years.
40 years.
Winning the Copa del Rey on penalties against Mallorca in what was a completely enthralling, engrossing final.
It was. And incredible. And at Mallorca, condolences, commiserations. They won the same trophy about 20 years ago. A fairy tale run for their own. I can't lie. I was rooting for Athletic Club just because of the period of time and the culmination of a project in Valverde and all the legacy. We'll get into that in a sec. But in terms of the actual game of football, both teams absolutely brought it. And I think the emblem of this game for me, the Williams brothers, Iñaki and Nico, and particularly Nico, just irresistible. You know, there is something about players that will not be denied. And the amazing thing about these brothers in particular, the run they went on, I mean, this is the final, but from the quarterfinal onwards, these two have just been lights out. We'll get into the flow of the game in a moment, but one thing I love about Nico Williams' assist for the goal is that it was like one of those gunfights. You know, there's like those Westerns where the person's in a bar fight and they fire all the bullets and then they just throw the pistol once the gun is empty.
It's quite funny that you say that because on the assist, I thought that I did hear a pew, pew.
Yeah.
Like a very kind of like, pew, you know, like the real Western sound effects, like pew.
So just this, quickly to recap. So to recap, Athletic Club won 4-2 on penalties after extra time. So 1-1 draw in after 2 hours.
Yeah. What was after 90 after, minutes? And it stayed that way, didn't it?
That's right. Extra time was fairly fraught, as you'd imagine in a game of this importance. So Rodriguez putting Mallorca ahead. It was interesting because I thought Athletic Club had just begun to take control.
I thought they started very very nervous.
And it was sad because this was a bit of a redemption arc for Nico Williams because the first real opening they had was when Nico Williams played a bad pass and it went out for a corner. And from the eventual melee, they ended up scoring through Rodriguez. Lovely finish, cut into the corner. Nico Williams then went in a kind of rampage. had this like gorgeous loud goal after 1-2.
Yeah.
Spiritually onside, actually. Have to say.
Oh, absolutely.
It was. I mean, it was gorgeous. It was a gorgeous goal. And then he set up Sanchet early in the second half for the 1-1. And just throughout, there's an amazing moment early in this game where, by the way, shout out to the crowds. The atmosphere was
incredible. It was so loud. And also,
sold out
San Mamés. They sold out San Mamés just putting screens up, watching the final.
Incredible, isn't it? It's incredible.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, unreal. There was a moment early in this game. You know, there's when you're like, is this cup final going to really take off? And Iñaki Williams gets the ball out on the right flank and just cooks three challenges.
Mm.
Weaves in, out, then lays out to the right flank. And I'm like, no, they're both locked in. The wingers are flying. I thought Athletic Club, I think they deserved, obviously just not because of the penalties, but because of the fact that Mallorca maybe had a bit less in attack, if that's fair. But then again, who doesn't have less in attack than these lot in the cup? But they absorbed pressure really well. What I loved about what Athletic Club did was they just kept trying to find openings. And eventually that was the difference, I think. But yeah, a great match. How did you find it?
I could see the first half, I think you could see Athletic were kind of aware of the occasion.
Mm.
I thought they were good, but you could sense that there was quite a lot of pressure on them to deliver this.
Yeah.
And I know that Valverde wouldn't really... He never really gives the impression that he's nervous or he looks under pressure, but I feel as though, especially with his relationship with the club, the job that he's been doing since he's returned there, especially after what happened at Barca, there's been this sense of momentum for a while. And especially kind of if you think they knocked out Barca and they knocked out Atleti to get to the final. And they kind of went into the final favourites, which I think is probably quite a rare thing for Athletic. Especially in recent years, because the last time they won it, they'd won La Liga back-to-back, I think, a couple of years before that. And if you go way back, I mean, there's only one club that's won more Copa del Reyes. That's Barca. Barca are the only club who have won more Copa del Reyes than Athletic Club. And so to give you a sense of like their history in the competition, they're 24th now. Real Madrid have won 20, you know. So you could sense that there was this, okay, we're here, we've kind of knocked out some of the people that we weren't favourites for. Now we're favourites.
Right.
You could just sense that there was a little bit of nerves there, understandably so. But once, I think they're overall playing the game, I think they deserve to win. They had like by far the most possession. But also though, I think this is where you have to credit Mallorca, because there was that bit after the game that you saw, like when Mallorca went up to get their medals and all the Athletic fans were clapping.
They were really, can I say,
it was a really, like, half time, really good final on that sense.
There was a moment, yeah, it's funny you mentioned this actually, that when they went off at half time, there were the two sets of players, they were talking to each other, like in a very friendly, like middle of a cup final. And it was not some kind of, you know, ice grills at 2 meters apart. There was genuine, I think, camaraderie. And I think this is because these two clubs have played some brilliant football for the last 20 years at least, like Mallorca and Athletic Club. They've been a credit to the division. And also they've come up in an era when they've been playing that football in an era when, of course, those other clubs have been dominant. Like these have been, it's an unusual period. Madrid, well, Real, both clubs, well, both huge clubs, Atletico Madrid and Real Madrid and Barcelona can all point to this period as one of the greatest periods in their clubs' histories. All three of them. They can all point to that. This is the context in which Athletic Club in particular have been forced to compete. And they've done that with obviously the Basque-only policy, which is even more remarkable. And so players only born in the Basque region obviously can play for them. The thing about that is there's a couple of things there. So first of all, Athletic Club, because of that talent pool, don't have to be a selling club. So there is the benefit they can keep the talent in-house as long as they can.
But when they do sell...
But because they coach them so well, those players all go on and do incredible things. Mm. Like it's an incredible talent base. And I'm just really glad that they get a trophy to crown this era. We've talked about this before where clubs, you know, like you had Spurs with Pochettino, they have these golden eras, but they don't actually have the, Yeah, same with Real Sociedad, actually, funny enough. They have these incredible periods where you need some kind of trophy. And if you look at this, for Athletic Club, this is kind of, this is not to sound patronizing, this is kind of a La Liga for them. If you think about it, I mean, this is as good. You're not going to beat, just because of resources, you are not going to beat Real Madrid to a league title or Barcelona. You're just not, because you don't have the squad depth. You can thrash them week in, week out. We saw it with Bielsa's era. Like Pep said, they have the best team. And it was the two-all draw, the famous two-all draw they had back in the Pep, you know, peak Pep, peak Barcelona. And he said, that's the best team in La Liga, but they don't have the resources to play that way every week. Mm. They don't have the players. So in terms of their arc, this is, it's not their La Liga, because they could technically win that, but this is as impressive in its own right, I think, as Barca or Real Madrid winning La Liga. I think it's as impressive, if not more so.
I mean, they've just been hard to beat. Do you know what I mean? Like they've lost six times in the league, but they've got the second best defensive record.
This is it, exactly. But it's depth.
The way
it's
that
depth.
Valverde, yeah, for sure. And that, but that's, you're always going to get that. And that's the kind of, if you think they are fifth in a league, and they're doing it with this Basque only policy.
Yes,
the Williams brothers are such a like a major part of that. I've seen two brothers, especially with their background, playing for Athletic. This is honestly one of the best things from this season for me.
It's a family. It's amazing because it's like a family triumph within a family club. If that makes sense.
Yeah,
family. Like, it's so powerful in that sense. And you talk about coaching. I mean, on the Williams brothers, just put a point there because I want to come back to them in a sec. But I want to give a shout to Aguirre Zabala in the Athletic Club goal, because Unai Simón was on the bench for this game, and that is Spain's number one. And this is similar to the Alisson Kelleher dynamic in the Cups, where Klopp was like, you're playing in the Cup, and if we get to the final, you'll be playing in that final too, because you've earned your way there. And the temptation to swap out a goalkeeper for Unai Simón, or, well, the country's number one, in a game of this magnitude is one which I'm not sure all coaches would have resisted. I'm not convinced. I think what he did there to back him, and you know, he made, you know, great performance in the shootout in particular. And I thought that in itself was a really remarkable show of faith. Great, you know, typically understated from Valverde. He wouldn't have made a big deal after that, but it was a big deal, I think. But in terms of what he's brought out of the Williams brothers, like Iñaki has been brilliant for years.
Yeah.
But I feel like also, I mean, this, we talk about final form. I feel this is his final form. The way he combined with his brother, with Nico, in that semi-final when they blew away Atletico Madrid early on. I mean, very, very few clubs will do that to a Diego Simeone team in a game of that importance. They absolutely, I mean, I can't remember a game when they did, maybe this is the Cristiano Ronaldo hat-trick in the Champions League, because the last time I've seen a Simeone team at that stage just absolutely roasted. But what he's brought out of Iñaki, he's brought a yet higher level out of him, which is something, saying something, because he's already been brilliant. But the Nico Williams stuff is just...
But Valverde has just coached them both, the pair of them on both wings. You know what I mean? On either wing, sorry. It's just...
Dude.
That's dangerous. And you were talking about depth, and there's a really interesting thing where like Munain came off the bench, right?
Yeah, that's big.
He's lost five finals with Athletic. 2015 and 21, they won the Supercoppers. But obviously, it's like kind of winning the Community Shield.
This is also like, this is justice for that incredible Athletic Club side that got to the Europa League final against the virtually unstoppable Atletico Madrid back in, I think, 2012. That was an incredible team. And Herrera, Turaspe, and, you know, built back coached by Bielsa. So it really feels like this completes the arc. For Munain as well, because Munain's been on that, I mean, you talk about heroes' journeys, there's been a few of them have really, some of these,
I
some
mean,
of these
Raul
players
Garcia, man. Raul Garcia is 37, you know, and I know that he might not be everyone's favourite player.
He's
in
not
the world,
attracted a lot of sympathy outside,
because let's just say he spent a lot of his career being an absolute bastard, right? But but if you think, goes to Athletic Club in what, 2015, and spends a decade there and wins a trophy in his final season.
He would definitely be an 11 of that nature with Pepe, for sure.
Jesus. Like, for sure. I'm not sure if we've done the shithouse 11, but if we need to go and do another one, then he's going in there.
Raul Garcia is one of those. He's one of those players where someone says their name, they just kick up some dust. Like, instinctively, they're just like kissing up.
Exactly.
If he shows his face around here.
Ander Herrera as well, man. Like, Ander Herrera on the bench, didn't come off the bench, but, you know, winning a trophy at Athletic Club, I think it's just, I think it must be such a special thing for especially in the modern
incredible
era.
Incredible. Yes.
Ernesto Valverde deserves so much love and so much credit, because this is a guy who, there were some errors at Barca, we know that, but if you look at how they've aged now, man, if we knew then what we knew now, I think the treatment of Valverde would have been extremely different. And actually, the way that he coached that side and the way that he handled himself, remember, not long before he was fired, they were talking about, they were offering it to Xavi. They were offering the job to Xavi
in that
while
era.
He was still in three competition. You know,
in that era, in that Xavi in that
but
moment,
pre Setien as well, like before they even got Setien, they were offering Xavi the job at Barcelona while Ernesto Valverde was still there. He was overlooked by Manchester United in favor of Rangnick,
yeah,
and he just kind of sat there and then waited to go back to Athletic, a place that is what he's done it. This is his third time there.
Yeah,
was there as a player. His face. There were two things about this. Nico and Iñaki hugging got me.
Amazing.
Like, I was gone. But when they win the penalty shootout and Valverde kind of puts his head in his hands, it kind of dawns on him what he's actually done. And he was asked after, like, of all the trophies he's won, and he was just like, this is the best by a mile. Like, this is it.
It can't come close, can it? It cannot come close. For his storyline, his arc, what he's done, I mean, I mentioned that word a lot, but it just feels like a lot of people have completed a journey here. Munain, Herrera, you know, veterans of those great teams from before that didn't get trophies, that had to watch everyone else walk past and were unfavored in so many great finals. Like 2015, when they got blown away by that incredible Messi goal, people forget Athletic Club were there in the kind of, they were there the whole time in the picture, but never really got their moment. And for Valverde as well, like, you know, I've talked about this 1,000 times, but he made his mistakes in the Champions League, but was so disrespected. And look, the only consolation for him is almost nobody leaves Barcelona universally beloved. Like, almost nobody. It just doesn't really. And for God's sake, even Messi didn't, you know, if we're being real.
He was there just as the tipping point started to happen with the Barcelona chaos.
He was.
Era.
Where some of the recruitment wasn't ideal. Some of the players weren't as mentally resilient as could have been, should have been, because a lot of people look back to that 4-0 defeat at Anfield, but there were players that were accountable for that. There's a lot that's going on there too.
I'm just really, really delighted for him. Someone we've always really rated and just continuously overlooked manager in the world of football, especially considering he managed Barcelona. I think when the time does come for him to move from Athletic, I would be surprised if there aren't more people after him. But also, sometimes, I mean, we've talked about this before, like, when you find a place to land, like, there's nothing better than that.
He'll end up like curating the Berlinale or something. He won't move into football next. He'll do something else. He'll be like some, you know, the director of like the European City of Culture. Mm. He'll end up doing that. But I know you mean.
But
if
this
he does
is the thing,
if,
like,
he,
do you know what I mean?
If
like,
he stays
I mean,
in football,
we always have a tendency to kind of be like, okay, is this team going to break up now? You know, we're talking about it with Leverkusen, or where's this manager going to go next? Like, it was all about like, is Xabi Alonso going to go to Liverpool? Is he going to go to Real Madrid? And he's just like, no, I'm going to stay put here. This is the place to be. And I think that I think especially people who are so Premier League focused underestimate the desire for people to win in a place that they want to win. I think, like, totally. I mean, he might end up in the Premier League at one point, Valverde. Who knows? I mean, he's 60. He's not getting any younger.
Mm.
Winning Athletic's first major trophy in 40 years at the club that he's managed 3 times, he played there, is going to mean more than I don't know, like getting a Premier League.
It's like Totti, staying at Roma. It's like Totti staying at Roma.
Yeah.
And all the people that like threw money at, I mean, goodness, the offers that Totti would have got. And I'm sure there's a point when Totti's agent was just like, he's not going to answer. Stop emailing, stop calling me. He's not going to come. He's not going to budge. And I think you look at Totti's career and how it played out. The man won a Scudetto with Roma, just the one, but no, but even the way they won it was sensational. And then won a World Cup with Italy and was pivotal in that too. And you look at that career and you just think, how many footballers now would swap what they did in their trophy cabinet for what he achieved and the way he did it and the love that he got? Because one thing that Totti clocked very early, one thing Valverde clocked very early, not a lot of footballers do and managers do, is the love is everything, actually. Mm. It is. It really is. The same with Valverde as a coach. Like Valverde's genius has been to understand the moment, to understand the stage and the culture and the community. And the reason I love this so much from him is because he's brought something. He's brought so much joy to like, what, three generations of fans? There are literally football fans. There are Athletic Club football fans who'll be like, I can die happy now that I've seen us win. And he's done that.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a legacy.
They have this famous thing about they do a parade on the barge. Right?
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. You picked that up. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there was a quote in a Sid Lowe piece that Unai Simon said, like, we need to check if it still floats because it's been so long. Apparently there were a million people lying in the banks last time. I imagine there'll be many more.
Any consolation to Mallorca, you will be eating wonderful food with which to console yourselves. Can I say the buffet, the banquet that will be put on? I wanted to hold back on this, but Ryan, the food that will be eaten in celebration, I don't want to demean the moment, but if there are any listeners of this podcast who, should you have any spare choice morsels left over from the feast, feel free to send them to Berlin. Joking aside, if there are any Athletic Club fans listening to this podcast and they have a particularly delicious meal to celebrate, please just send us the details of what you had. That'd be really lovely, I think.
If you have also, a nice meal, if you want to read about the food of the Bass Derby, Abbas Asaria wrote a piece for the Stadio Sign.
He wrote an absolute cracker, didn't he?
The food.
Love that piece. Yeah, yeah.
Shout out to Abbas. Anyway, congratulations to Athletic Club. Congratulations to Ernesto Valverde. An amazing achievement.
Yes.
We should probably take a break because we've got a lot more to
say. Let's do it. We do.
All right, man. So we've put it off long enough. We're going to talk about the one of the wildest games of the weekend.
Go for it.
Heidenheim's comeback. No, I can't do it. It's going to be Manchester United against Liverpool. Manchester yes. United 2, Liverpool 2 at Old Trafford. Manchester United at the moment are moving like, you know, when you think you're just going for a quiet beer with a few friends on a Friday, just meeting in the pub, and there's one friend that's there, and you know that's it. The night is.
Yes.
There's going to be like a round of shots at 9:30 pulled up, and you're like, what are you doing?
This literally happened a few days ago.
Manchester United are that friend at the moment. They are ready to party. And they're dragging you down to their level, whether you like it or not.
They're absolutely. Embrace the chaos. They are absolutely.
I fucking love it. I love it.
I do love it. It's wild.
On Thursday's show, I said I was thoroughly looking forward to Chelsea, Manchester United.
You got everything you wanted.
Manchester United, with arguably back-to-back, two of the most fun games of the season. Yeah, what do you think about it? Because, I mean, they didn't have a shot in the first half.
Super weird because they didn't have a shot in the first half. And the yet time, they felt threatening. But first I couldn't explain. They felt like when you go to the beach in summer and there's like a storm cloud way off the coast, but it's a huge dark one. It's quite far off. And you're like, it's basically deciding whether or not to rain on you. That's what United were like in the first time. Yeah, never. It's just there, but you're like,
it's just pack up
the picnic and go home. Actually, didn't really cook. And I think United were like that in the first half. Liverpool, meanwhile, were very much they were raining on that parade already. They were straight up in there, and they were relentless in terms of their chance creation. And I think I mentioned this to Ian actually when we were looking at the in Argentina in the first game of the World Cup against Saudi in the first half, Argentina were missing chances like a team that thought there'd always be more chances coming along. And I feel like Liverpool had that lack of, it wasn't lack of urgency in the chance creation, but the lack of decisiveness in the finishing. I mean, this
Liverpool
team
had
really
seven big chances.
Dude, Liverpool should have been 2-3-0. This is why, like, you know, so Kwanzaa played a bad pass for the equaliser for Bruno.
Would you want to talk about the first goal first? Because
yeah, of course.
There was a lot of talk about whose man should it have been, what the marking was.
Or was it just a well-worked corner? I don't know. I mean, just because...
I actually think Dallow needs to step off the line as soon as that breaks. Oh, that's
interesting.
Because you're on the line and actually you can at least close. You've got to be a little bit more aware to the danger.
I thought Cambuala was really good in that context. I think he cleared up. He made one or two errors, but he made only a couple of mistakes in this game. You know, this is a teenager playing in a huge game. And whenever he made a mistake, his recovery was outstanding. Like, he really made up for any trouble he caused. Really strong presence. So I don't think this goal was his fault. I think the Dallow thing is a good shout. I just thought it was a well-worked corner. One of those ones where it felt almost like, you know, the one that City got against Liverpool? The Stones goal, where it was almost like the pressure was so intense that something was going to go in at some point. Like the Onana save from Szoboszlai. I know that Onana gets a lot of criticism from shot stopping. That save from Szoboszlai, when he claws it down away from the top corner, was absolutely next level. And it just felt like a constant barrage. There's a stat you pulled up from the Jonathan Wilson article about, well, Liverpool have unleashed 87 shots on United's goal in three matches.
In three games.
And haven't beaten them.
That is unbelievable.
This is the thing about Onana in the context in which we have to judge his goalkeeping. You had Casemiro in this game being routinely bypassed. Just physically, it's a physical decline thing, but also just in terms of when in possession didn't look sharp. Like, there was a thing where it wasn't just that he was being bypassed in terms of sprinted, but like just the tired legs that lead to bad touches in this game. You saw him, like, you know, in the last 10 minutes, played a really poor clearance and just thought, he's knackered. He's absolutely hosed. And it's not necessarily because he's poor, it's because physical decline plus ground you're expected to cover in that midfield. Even Kobbie Mainoo, like, very, very good player, but even he looked isolated just because of the configuration, because
he's also so young. I mean, that's the thing about that midfield. It's just, it's like, it's kind of non-existent.
It's vacant. You've got Casemiro, who can't really run. You've got Kobbie Mainoo, who can cover ground, but he's covering 60 yards because Bruno is like up there. You've almost got like a kind of, you've basically got a 4-2-4, but one of the two can't really run. Against a
we were having a little bit of chat about whether Manchester United need to reconfigure this midfield a little bit, especially now Mason Mount is coming back to fitness.
I think Mount and Mainoo solves a huge number of problems very quickly. Same way that McTominay in the mix, positionally, I think if you look at what he'd done for Scotland actually in the Euros and the 0-0 draw, in terms of discipline, he can really do it if you want. I think it's funny, maybe I'm a bit biased towards the Bundesliga, but watching what Xabi Alonso has done with the back three, I think that formation that Bayer Leverkusen use would actually play to so many strengths of this United squad. I think if you've got one defender back from injury, I think a back three for United actually, if you look at Bruno and McTominay as tens potentially, or Bruno and Rashford behind a Hoyland, and fullbacks pushing high and three centre-backs and then like Mount and Mainoo in between. I think that's actually, and then I think that's a really strong offering. And then McTominay off the bench, either as a nine or, you know, you can imagine how someone like, I'm just thinking of how, let's say, Xabi Alonso would use these players. And the thing I love about the Xabi Alonso 3-4-2-1 is that it hides weaknesses, specifically mobility. I think the one thing that Xabi Alonso's team maybe doesn't have in the center is like extreme mobility of the two players sitting, but doesn't need that. And I think that framework allows more match control, more dynamism, and allows the kind of chaotic players, for example, in that formation, the two tens, it allows Bruno to be Bruno. Look how much freedom Florian Wirtz gets, but doesn't sacrifice any solidity. Because if Bruno Fernandes is going to be this kind of dynamic player that goes and does his thing, you need to have that bed behind him, the two sixes. Mm. And it almost feels like, you know, having Eriksen there as a ball player, that doesn't, it doesn't work in the Premier League. This thing that United do of sacrificing possession, I mean, like 40% possession at home. You look at the results and you think, you know, week to week, United are playing some entertaining stuff. And you think, if you step back from it, the analytics team must be pulling their hair out. You look at this and think, this is not sustainable over the course of a league campaign.
No.
You talk to the stats, but the analytics people be like, this team being coached this way is not going to win a title. It's going to struggle to win anything other than cups, frankly. Because you get caught up in the romance of it. It leaves a bit of a hangover, because once the kind of euphoria clears, a big result, or, you know, a draw against the, it's not even a big result, to be honest, because it's a 2-2 draw. And I hate to sound harsh, but in terms of setting standards, but you're 2-1 up at Old Trafford. You have to close that out. Once you get that lead.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about this though, because also you've got to remember that Manchester United are undefeated in 3 games against Liverpool this season. They've won 2 and drawn 1. Drawn 2-1-1. Out of the top 3, Liverpool are probably the side who don't have the ability to completely control games in the way that like Manchester City and Arsenal do. And yet they had.
Yes, yes.
They kind of strolled through Man United's midfield with ease. Just purely wasted chances. I don't know, like you said, like they kind of were playing like a side who just kept expecting that they were going to have chances, but they should have been out of sight at half time, really. Mm. And as soon as it's not, you know that Manchester United have got a chance to do this to you. And the goal, actually, do you know what? Kevin Kelleher was really, really lucky that he didn't make contact with that, because he's outside his box by about five. He's about 5 yards outside his box and he dives for it.
Oh, the Bruno one.
For the Bruno goal.
That is a bit, the way he, can I just say, the way he struck that, like little said, outside of the right, so a bit good. Of a, yeah, what's it, a bit of fade? Call
a
it?
A little bit of fade. Yeah. Love that. Yeah.
Fade, yeah. Loved that. Gorgeous goal. And then, as I said in the chat, Cobby Fowler with a turn and finish in the top corner. That was, like, I love this goal for him because it was such a glow up moment, because there are people that pay attention to him for the midfield play, the deft stuff, but other people that see him on the radar, his name doesn't pop up. But the thing I love about that goal is going viral on TikTok as we speak. That was a real, that was very much, for those who weren't already in the know, that was his coming out party, I think, that goal. Just in terms of seeing the quality of what he can do. And also, just in terms of like the attacking tools that he's got, because he can do, we know he can do the slick defensive midfield stuff, but that goal showed something else in his locker. So great goal there for him. Mo Salah with his almost customary goal against Manchester United, the penalty spot. And this was, I felt for Wan-Bissaka here, because he's done so much good in attack and in defence, to be fair to him, like, you know, really strong one-to-one defender. So for him to come up with this tackle was...
He just didn't need
I wouldn't say it was wildly uncharacteristic. It was just that he's just such a good one-to-one defender. And you're like, he's one of the last people you'd expect, like, on the team sheet to come up with that tackle like that. So I think he's looking at that just thinking, I cannot believe I fell for that, really.
For Liverpool, this is just one of those ones where they just need to focus on taking chances. I think if they created nothing, I'd be really, really worried about Liverpool. But the fact that they created so much and they just didn't finish, you're going to have days like this. It needs to, they need to refocus a little bit.
Darwin, a couple of decisions, and just choices.
I missed a couple. Just a wild game. Gary Neville's head was gone after about a quarter of an hour. He could not believe what was going on. He was just like, it's like a load of 12-year-olds. And actually, I texted you, didn't I, saying it was like one of those Japanese game shows where they have like 3 professionals against 100 kids.
Yes.
Everyone was just running in the same direction, and there were just people running all over the place. It was just like, I know that's kind of the point of football sometimes, but not 2 games in a row, Manchester United, I've been watching the TV and I've been like, people are running in a way, I'm not used to this kind of thing at the very top level of football. Just
Ryan, I was talking to a friend and I said, I've got to rewatch this game because I felt like I was hallucinating. I felt like it was a hallucinogen. I said, because I'm trying to analyze these games and nothing is going where it's meant. And I'm just, have I, I go into like a trance-like state where I'm watching, going, okay, that player's meant to be there. And you're kind of like sitting there trying to like sort of trace out this person's coming. I'm like, no, none of it's happening. It's extraordinary.
I don't really know. Yeah. I mean, it's almost like unanalyzable, really.
Yeah. Cause the players are where they're meant to be. It's what's that thing about, I don't know a thing about like quantum mechanics, whatever, but the way you observe particles, right. And they start changing the moment we start observing them. I feel like Man United are like that at the moment. The moment you start observing them, they start behaving completely differently. You're like, what are you doing over there? Why have you popped over here? I mean, we had Bruno playing centre-back and it wasn't weird. Bruno Fernandes playing centre-back in the late stages of the FA Cup against Liverpool is the least weird thing a Manchester United player has done. It's like, oh, that makes sense. Like, there was a counter-attack. There was a moment where he was like in the Liverpool box, I think it was, in the FA Cup game. And the counter-attack begins and he's the first player back. Once the camera pans across, I'm like, are there two Brunos? Like, is there like a quantum Bruno? Is there two of him? Or is it just like, how is he still sprinting that much? And actually, on that note, while I'm here on this, because I want to give credit in among the jokes, Rasmus Højlund has a better goal return. He has a better goal return for Man United than he did for Atalanta, and he's doing more with less. The Atalanta team was scoring more than this United team, and it was creating more, and he's doing more with less. He's more efficient in that sense. I was saying the other day to you, I think, this guy probably has like more sprints per touch than almost anyone. In terms of a forward, the way he's used, I don't think he's been deployed to best effect. I really don't. I really believe that. We've talked about Bayer Leverkusen already. Can you imagine how many goals Rasmus Højlund would score in that Bayer Leverkusen team with two tens playing? And it was just, but the volume, like he is doing this well in a team that does not play to his strengths, where he's not fed passes in behind, his touch, his movement, his pressing. I just think if things align for him as a striker, he just will go to another level. Like a level of, this is like a 20, 25 goal a season striker.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's got all the tools to. Yeah. Can I shout out Harry Maguire as well? Because I actually think Harry Maguire played really, really well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, look, against a young partner in a huge game. So not just his own play, but the stewardship. Yeah. The caretaking.
He was really good. Yeah. Like he was very kind of steady, rarely put a foot wrong. In a very chaotic game, he had a calm head, which I think was really important for Manchester.
Well, you look at the Van Dijk-Quansah dynamic. It's similar to what Maguire was doing in this game with Cambuala. Similar thing in terms of the elder statesman having to sort of shepherd the younger player. And he did that. So a game of this intensity, really, really good. Yeah.
Did we get everything on that game?
I think we did. Yeah. We got all the vitamins out of it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Manchester United 2, Liverpool 2, Sheffield United 2. Chelsea 2, a 93rd minute equaliser.
McBurnie.
From Oliver McBurnie.
Sheffield United, what, two sort of epic score draws in recent weeks.
Mm.
Obviously, falling back against Fulham. So really good they could claim this. And I mean, they're not making a kind of, how to say this best, going down with a fight, I think.
Mm.
Like if they are going to go down, they'll at least be able to say we offered some significant resistance. And shout out to them for this because, man, they persisted. And Chelsea, strange week for them.
Oh, yeah.
I think we were chatting about this before, like, you know, winning 4-3 against United, but still somehow in a weird way, not going entirely backwards, but it's hard to see where their progress is because, you know, we've said this so many times with Chelsea, they're kind of going through what United went through, you know, maybe a few months ago, where you have these positive performances and you can almost like give them too much meaning because the moment you see something the four-all draw false against City is a classic example. Yeah, yeah, false hope.
Yeah, and then it is because like, I mean, the Thursday, the win over Manchester United was one of those things where like no one really won. Really. No one came out of that looking great. You know what I mean? It's one of those, really, wasn't it?
We're all a bit ashamed of ourselves.
Yeah, it was just like, who cares? Like, it was really fun. It would have been amazing as a fan of Chelsea fans. Like, who gives a fuck what anyone else thinks? Like, enjoy the wins, man. We'd like celebrate every win like you've won the league.
No, that's true. That's true.
In football or in life, who cares what other people think about it? A shout, Spurs beating Forest 3-1. Mickey van der Ven with an absolute...
That is a gorgeous strike.
It's like McAllister's the other day as well, man. Two contenders for Angry Goal of the Year when the Stadio's come around.
Yes, absolutely. Forest had a chance. They thrashed against the post from like a couple of yards out.
Yeah, yeah.
And then van der Ven came in. I mean, throughout though, I mean, Spurs just had much more in terms of the chance creation. And
well, you say that though.
The XG.
Exactly the same XG.
Forest had more chances. I think I said it because of the confidence of the finishing.
Yeah, true.
You know, Spurs just looked like they had that, you know, the cliched extra gear, but they did. Timo Werner again, doing good work out wide. Porro with a delightful third. Mm. And Spurs stealing a bit of a march on Villa, who were held by Brentford. That was a bad result for them, being held at home, the 3-0 draw.
Yeah. Wild game.
I wonder if they're still a bit groggy from... I mean, Watkins is back, got two great ones, but I wonder if they're still slightly groggy from the defeat to City. So that might have maybe knocked them a little bit. Who knows?
City, meanwhile, you mentioned City beat Palace 4-2 on Saturday lunchtime.
De Bruyne doing De Bruyne things.
De Bruyne was just like, write me off at your peril.
Yes.
Some people said I was done. Well.
But no, but De Bruyne is one, he's like one of those, you know, De Bruyne is like, he's like one of those grime MCs who are like, ah, clash me at your peril. And it's like, no one would clash you. Everyone's afraid.
Speaking of like, no one's coming at you, Rico Lewis's celebration.
That was, what was that?
Chatting in your ear. It's like, dude.
No one's talking yet.
No one's talking.
You're still in that face. Everyone's rooting for you. Like, everyone likes you. Yeah. Everyone's like, oh, Rico Lewis. It was a bit like watching Tarek Lamptey do it. Like, why would you?
I realized at that moment that at one point, I want to see Rico Lewis and Gavi in the same side. They need to egg each other on.
Yeah, but somebody needs to ask, you're right. And also, yeah, I love that as a shout. He's very much the English Gavi. Someone needs to ask these people.
He's not, though. That's the thing. He's not at all. But I just think after that, just a bit like, oh, has he got a little bit?
Oh, definitely.
Gavi's too scrappy.
Give it time.
Rico Lewis almost seems a little bit cerebral.
So did Gavi. Gavi did at the beginning.
No, Gavi never. Gavi, in like Gavi's third game, he played the entire game with his shoelaces undone.
There was always a dust cloud following that boy. There was.
But anyway, it was just fun. And De Bruyne's goal, unbelievable. Mm. And very, very good win for City. Yeah. Well, both De Bruyne's goals were good, actually. And Haaland's back in goal-scoring form. You mentioned Villa drawing 3-0 with Brentford. Everton getting a much-needed win against Burnley. Their first win since they last played Burnley. Newcastle beating Fulham 1-0.
They're on a bad run, Fulham.
They kind of don't they?
Yeah. Mm.
They go on a tear and then they go on a really patchy run of form. You know, they beat Spurs 3-0 and then it's like 3-0 against Sheffield United, 3-1 losing 3-1 against Forest and then losing at home to Newcastle. Luton beating Bournemouth. Great result for Luton. 2-1. Yes. 90th minute winner for them. And West Ham beating Wolves 2-1. Disallowed goal for Wolves, and a lot of people seem to be very unhappy about that.
Mm.
Which, I don't know. Yeah, I didn't think it was quite as outrageous. As
I don't think it was.
Was making it out to be. But anyway. Final game. Arsenal beating Brighton 3-0. Do you know what? Brighton, actually, in that first half, although Arsenal statistically looked really good, Brighton did something to Arsenal that not a lot of teams have done this season, and they actually, like, created space.
Mm.
I was actually quite impressed with them for a little bit until the goal. But yeah, penalty for Saka ended up being quite comfortable in the end.
Yeah, they looked good. Best move of the game was for the second goal.
The Havertz goal.
That reverse, the reverse pass.
Mm.
Martin the Magician playing it inside, Jorginho squaring it. And Havertz, the movement for this.
So good.
The movement. There were three Brighton players in and around, and he just weaved in through the gap. Smoked through a ravine, got in there, cut in. And it was funny because there was a moment in the United-Liverpool game where United square it and no one cuts in to score. I remember thinking, guy would have scored that. Just in terms of the anticipation of space and cutting in, so that was really good. And then he got the assist for Trossard, and I think Trossard had, there was a bit of friction, wasn't there, I think, towards the end of Trossard's time at Brighton. He was in his bag celebrating this. He loved
it. I think he handled it just about right, though. It was deniable.
It was enough.
It was a bit like, yeah. Well, did I really celebrate or did I just stand there with my arms out?
But everyone who was watching knew what it was. Everyone was like, we know. Yeah, yeah, we know what this is.
But it wasn't enough. Like, he wasn't running around, like, kissing the badge, kicking the corner flag. You know what I mean?
No,
giving it the kind of like, what?
But this was impressive control. Impressive control from Arsenal, I thought.
This was chalked down as a big, you know, worrying away.
What's the
away
stat you sent me about away clean sheets? What's that stat you sent me?
Five consecutive clean sheets away in the league, and it's the first time they've done that since 1997.
This is a hell of
a team. Statistically, they're just really good. I think the Bayern, this little run, if they get through Bayern without a huge amount of drama, which I think is possible, I think it's going to be a tough game, but... it's interesting to see where Bayern are at in Europe.
Can I say about Bayern?
Well, we can segue from Bayern if you like. They were 2-0 up away at Heidenheim, who have the smallest budget in the league. Came up this season. They are doing really well, though. And I actually think if Xabi Alonso wasn't going to win the league, Frank Schmidt would be up for manager of the season in the Bundesliga.
Oh, he's definitely in the conversation. Yeah. He's in the conversation. Like, he's going to be honorable mention. Can I say, in terms of what Heidenheim did? So, they went 2-0 up, Bayern. Harry Kane with the first, his 32nd league goal of the season. And then Gnabry, but even Gnabry's celebration was interesting. He did a sort of like stir in the teacup. I thought this, it's so like half-hearted.
That's his thing though, isn't
it? It is. But it looked like, I'm not knocking him, but it's like it felt like symbolic in terms of, if he'd known what was coming, he would have celebrated more. He would have taken his joy.
Maybe he didn't expect it. You know what I mean? Because they were 2-0 up and cruising away at Heidenheim.
So the first goal, I think that the second goal they conceded, so the equaliser, was so concerning. The flick on, I think it was Kleindienst's first. So Kleindienst meaning small service, but he gave no small service the title race, if I may. So, the flick, so there's a flick on, and Kim Min-jae gets beaten to the flick on. The ball drops into a gap between Alphonso Davies and Upamecano, and the ball gets hooked into space. Kleindienst is through, and it's 2-2. And the real concern about this, and he saw it with the winner, this was the real concern. I don't like to call individual players out. Sertel basically is engaged with a Heidenheim player in a sprint, and Alphonso Davies looks up, and you know how fast he is. I got to say this, Ryan, is a guy with that speed to end up even further behind the action by the time the ball enters the net. And I thought, that is a worry. Like, because in terms of like sheer foot race, recovery speed, how many times have you seen Alphonso Davies make a sprint and come back and at least contest? And the Bayern players are not contesting. There's this strange thing where there's a lack of chemistry, first of all, but there's also a lack of urgency in clearing up other people's mistakes. This is a major, major problem. And Tuchel might look at that. You know, he was talking afterwards. And I think actually in a funny kind of way, he covers his players pretty well because he didn't call out people in that sense. If he didn't like point fingers at X, Y, Z, he's like, not sure why we're not doing this.
He's going in the summer as well. He could go off, but he's not doing it.
But I look at this Bayern squad and I think they actually have to ring some changes. Like, we know a couple of players are leaving so many. But it really is the lack of intensity and desire. They're just not enjoying it to the same. Actually, that's not, it's just, you can't say they're not enjoying it, but I'm just not seeing the urgency from the Bayern players in this. And this is not to discredit Heidenheim.
Max Eberl's got a big job on his hands, man.
He does.
Max Eberl,
this is not to knock.
Former Gladbach and Leipzig sporting director now at Bayern, took over what? January? He got the job there? February? I think he went in March, actually. His first transfer window coming up, and he's got a lot to do. Got a lot to do in the summer.
I think he's lucky in a way, though. Do you know why? Because, and we talk about the rot. I mean, they're second in the league, but there is an element of rot. He's lucky because the shortcomings are so clear that it actually gives him more authority in a funny way. He has authority to go in and go, actually, we need to clean house in these specific areas. A bit like, I mean, weird enough, you look at like Xavi, like just sort of with the pressure off, just playing the kids and going for it. And actually, in Xavi's defense, some of the stuff he did in the Copa del Rey run was quite impressive. Some of the stuff Barca have played has been really, really good. I think that if you look at Bayern in the summer, this is a real opportunity for like Project Reset. And as actually, I was out with a friend last night chatting about this, and he was like, look, I think there's a story about that in terms of Bayern and their regeneration, their revamp. I said, look, don't get me wrong, they'll have no sympathy from like most of Europe because they have these resources, but there is quite an exciting rebuild to be done at that team, I think, to retool. So, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, massive shout to Heidenheim for this because it's a great result. Yeah. And they're 10th now. They're above Gladbach. They're 3 points behind Freiburg. It's just an incredible season. To stay up anyway is one thing. To stay up so comfortably.
Yeah, the year they didn't come up, they got beaten by Werder in the playoff. I loved what they were playing that year. Yeah. And the fact they've come and they've solved all those problems, they've worked out all the kinks and now they've come in. I mean, this coaching job, you're right, what Frank Schmidt's done is...
unbelievable.
Dude. In fact, look, you can say, I mean, some of the coaching actually coming out of the Bundesliga the last few years has been absolutely elite.
Yeah.
Really has been.
It's been amazing. Leverkusen, meanwhile, they beat Union at the first try. 1-0. A penalty was enough. A few protests, but from the Union fans due to the kit that they were wearing. Because of the sponsorship, they were wearing a white Star Trek kit to advertise a new Paramount Plus series. And there were some banners said like home games in white for this marketing shite.
Man, they go in. They do go in.
Do you remember when Atleti was sponsored by, was it Sony Pictures or whatever? And they had that actual Spider-Man climbing up the side of the Calderon.
Unbelievable.
Genuinely incredible. Like, it's almost like been erased from history, though. It's really hard to find. Who was I talking to? I think I was talking to Colin Miller about it. And even like Colin had like, was like, what? This isn't something I dreamt. This actually happened. And I just, come on, man. Like, you know. Union playing red, play home games in red.
Absolutely, yeah.
But yeah, so Leverkusen now have extended their unbeaten run in all competitions to 41 games. In the UEFA era, they are 7 behind the all-time record, which was Benfica 63-65.
Unreal.
The longest ever, I mean, apparently before that, was Celtic. Way back in 1915-17, but since European competition has been in place in UEFA, Benfica are the highest. Yeah, 63-65.
Unreal. But they can win the league. That's right, isn't it? Next week, if they win,
they can win the league next week. Yeah, they're 16 points clear now at the top. Mm. There are 6 games left, so they match Bayern and Stuttgart's result next week. They will win the league because Stuttgart beat Dortmund on the weekend, which meant that they are level on points with Bayern. Both on 60 points.
Extraordinary. Like from them as well. What a season they're having, really.
Sebastian Hoeneß has got that team playing so well. I mean, bear in mind, this was the side that nearly went down. Very similar arcs to Leverkusen, actually.
Grassi doing work. It's just unbelievable.
I mean, Grassi has scored a great goal, missed an absolute sitter as well. And Dortmund, to be honest, Dortmund missed a couple of like really, really big chances. Like Schlotterbeck had that one from like 3 yards out. But yeah, another great result. Stuttgart. They've beaten Dortmund twice. They did double it.
They've been good value for that. I think just on this Leverkusen, so they'll be playing Werder Bremen next week and Werder in 12th at home. Like that is a game that Leverkusen should win, not just on form, but just in terms of like the head-to-head. And also what I like about Xabi in this game was, you know, maybe we'll have something to celebrate next weekend. Like he was talking about it as... It's funny with coaches. Some coaches are like, oh no, let's not talk about it one game at a time. But he speaks it into reality.
I think it's safe to talk about it.
Now. Right. But some coaches still wouldn't. I mean, look at,
Well, it was like early on in the season when Spurs were top of the league, right? And Ange Postecoglou was being asked about like whether Spurs fans can dream. And he was just like, let him, man. Yeah, get excited. What's the point of supporting the team? What's the point of following football if you can't get excited when things are going well? Mm. But anyway.
It's been really nice to spend time on like sort of Leverkusen social media and just see the fans and the gratitude for Xabi.
And the fact that he's staying is amazing and completely the right decision. And
love it.
Yeah. We'll talk in depth about them next week, I'm sure. But let's just quickly shout out a few other games. There were some derbies. Rangers 3, Celtic 3, a stoppage time equaliser for Rangers at Ibrox. There was a There was a really funny moment in this game, though, for the Rangers penalty, where Fabio Silva gets taken down. He gets booked for diving. And on comms, it went to VAR, and Chris Sutton was just like, it would be embarrassing if this was given a penalty. And the ref comes back and just goes, penalty. It was so funny.
I love it when pundits get cooked like that. I love it. It's all part of the fun.
But yeah, great game. Rangers have their game in hand this week away at Dundee. If they win that, they go top of the table.
Mm.
Other derbies to shout out. Rome derby, Derby della Capitale. Let's do Rome.
Eternal City. Mancini.
Winning it for Roma against Lazio.
This is a big deal in terms of Roma's run because they're just on the heels of Bologna, who are having an outstanding season. This was one where there was real skin in the game for both teams. Roma coming through, gorgeous header by Mancini, just on the stroke of half time. And this, I've got to get to Rome derby at some point in my life. The great American journalist Adam Serwer was there of The Atlantic, so he was very excited about that. And Blue Sky over on the other place, a social media.
Whoa, what's this Blue Sky?
It's not a Blue Sky.
I'm just gradually stepping away from social media, and you're on more platforms than ever before.
Not really. I'm just having a bit of fun. But other huge games the weekend. Final defeating.
Oh my
Ajax
god,
6-0. I did not catch this game.
Ajax just need the season to be done.
My sins, dude.
Ajax need the season to be over. So bad.
Horrible.
Yeah. Before we move on from the Rome derby, though, and we need to shout out Daniele De Rossi, because I think we were both a little bit concerned when he came in. And actually, the only games that he's lost since he's been there was to Inter and that second leg against Brighton, which they were 4-0 up from the first leg. He's done unbelievable from there. They could end up with a Champions League spot, which is absolutely incredible. And also, shout out to Tammy Abraham, came back. Tammy was back.
Yeah.
All in all, Roma turning a really, really tricky season around to potentially being...
especially also in the Europa League too, to do what they did to Brighton. Like, that's a...
fair play to Daniele De Rossi. He's really exceeded my expectations of what he could have done there so quickly.
Yeah, yeah. Great shout.
Norwich beating Ipswich 1-0 in the East Anglian derby. Nunez with a free kick was enough. That's 14 unbeaten in the derby for Norwich.
That's got to hurt. Hey, I know, man.
Especially with Ipswich kind of like pushing for promotion. Let's go to the West Coast. It was El Tráfico this weekend. LAFC winning 2-1 against LA Galaxy. Lisbon derby, Sporting beating Benfica 2-1. This was a very fun game indeed. It was also the Melbourne derby. Melbourne victory with a late win over Melbourne City FC. And one final game we need to talk about was a Turkish Cup final. Fenerbahce are in a bit of a wild month. They're only second in the table in the league, 2 points behind Galatasaray. But do you remember a few weeks ago when it all kicked off against Trabzonspor?
Right, right.
A few of the players fought back from the Trabzonspor fans like attacking Fenerbahce players.
Right.
Trabzonspor got a fan ban for a few games because of that. But still, I think a couple of players got charged.
Mm.
So Fenerbahce basically thought that they'd been really, really hard done by. Because of that, and them thinking that they were unfairly treated, the board gave members a vote whether or not to leave the Super League.
Leave or remain? Oh no, referendums, never.
They remained. They played in the cup final on the weekend, right? And apparently they'd asked for this game to be rescheduled because Fenerbahce are playing Olympiacos on Thursday in the Conference League, right? Mm. So they asked to postpone it to have more time to prepare.
Which is not wildly unfair. It's not unfair to ask that.
Incensed by all of this, they decided to field an under-19 side, conceded really early on to Icardi, and then just walked off the pitch. And basically Galatasaray had a kickabout with themselves. Like, the subs came on, they put bibs on, and they basically just played again like a training game.
Absolutely wild, Ryan. Walking off in a final, it's unusual. It's an unusual, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the president said after the final in the news conference, saying it's time for Turkish football to be reset. And then the club in a statement said that they took to the field not to win, but to defend the truth.
Yikes.
Yeah. So that's kind of big, though. I mean, it's kind of huge and it's kind of wild. So I think we'll keep an eye on that for sure.
Hmm.
All right, I reckon we leave it there. We hope everyone's staying safe, staying well. We're going to play out on a brand new one from JTC. called All Access, because kind of felt like everyone had all access to the middle part of the pitch at Old Trafford on Sunday. It was
open borders.
Just run wherever you want, guys. It's fine. It's fine. It's totally fine.
Listen, real heads know. You know that roundabout at Elephant and Castle? The chaos of that. It felt like that.
Wow. Righteous House with Ian and I after the Arsenal buying game on Tuesday. Stadio will be back on Thursday. Anything you'd like to add, Musa Gwonga?
I mean, we've added so much. No, nothing further.
No, right?
Not that addition.
Please don't add it anymore. All right, everyone, much love. We'll be back with you Thursday.